Eoch tanuyap, kuige iwans kuyens na. Hi everybody, my name is Kuige Iwans. I'm a member of the Squamish Nation and the Yogalanis clan of the Haida Nation. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. We live, work, play, and broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
I'm Macy Chen.
And I'm David Ball.
You're listening to CFRO, The Pulse, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We are your independent daily news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
And we're streaming at thepulse.coopradio.org. Good morning. It's Thursday, February the 11th. Today, power to the people. We're skipping the headlines to bring you a conversation about democracy, specifically democracy and how it affects issues that touch the downtown east side. After the riots at the US Capitol in January, I wondered about democracy in Canada. How well is democracy working in this country and for people in the neighborhood? A caveat for this show, I didn't capture a full picture of what everyone in the neighborhood thinks on this topic. In fact, there are only two people you'll hear from today. But the two people on the show gave me many thoughts about democracy, and I think this conversation can help add to the picture. We talked to Cheyenne Stonechild, an advocate for youth in care, and who used to live in the downtown east side. We also have Jennifer Wallowick, a researcher of democracy at SFU. This conversation is a fun one. Here are Cheyenne and Jennifer. Cheyenne Stonechild and Jennifer Wallowick, thank you so much for being on the show today. I would love to get right into discussion about democracy. And before we get started, maybe I can invite both of you to introduce yourselves and just speak about your relationship to this topic. Cheyenne, do you want to start?
Yes, sure. Thank you again for inviting me to be with you guys today. My name is Cheyenne Stonechild. I'm Cree from Fort Capel, Saskatchewan, and Irish from far off. I was born and raised here in Vancouver, BC. I've been doing youth advocacy for quite some time, since I was about 15, but I've also done some cultural work. So in the last 5 years, I have ran a cultural and history project for youth in and out of care to fill a gap that the Ministry of Child and Family Development has not been able to fill, despite their own policies demanding that they provide accurate and appropriate cultural care and knowledge to their kids. Yeah, it's kind of eaten up the last couple of years of my life, so happy times. Bad.
Oof. Well, Cheyenne, thank you so much for being here. Jen, I'll pass it to you next.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. And Cheyenne, it's lovely to meet you. I am a transplant from San Francisco. I've been in Vancouver for about 15 years. And I also want to recognize, because I think it's going to help ground our conversation today about our democracy and what it means for the future, that SFU and myself are on Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam's unceded lands, and to bring that history into our conversation. And part of the reason I do that is because my graduate school work was with the Gigamak Nkai Niska Society and Kosimshen youth, many of whom, Cheyenne, were in care or exiting care in Prince Rupert. So I think it's important to bring those perspectives into any conversation around democracy. And right now I work at the Simon Fraser University Morris J. Wasc Center for Dialogue. And my work specifically is around our democratic culture. How do we need to interact as people to improve our systems and improve the ways in which we can work together to solve some really hard challenges that we're facing?
Thanks, Jen. And I think that's a good launching point. Jen, could you speak about the research and what does it say just briefly about our democracy and trends? Because I heard that there's not a lot, there's some bad news on this front.
Yeah, so I'll start with some of the good. So our system's pretty stable. And actually, when you compare it to democracies across the globe, Canada ranks pretty high. In fact, The Economist last year ranked us as top number five. So our system's stable. We respect individual rights. Our governments have some accountability processes, and our courts are independent. We also have a culture that talks about how voting is important. So those are some of the good things. One of the bad things is that we really need to take a hard look at our systems and make them better reflect what we say our value of democracy is. So for example, we talk a lot about how democracy means equality among people. It's a core value, but our slow uptake of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's findings and what we're seeing around Black Lives Matter is really making us confront the reality that it never has been equal and it still isn't equal. So what this means kind of overall for we Canadians is that we believe democracy is a good utopian to shoot for. We think it's sort of a way forward, but we have a lot of work to do right now to get there.
And Cheyenne, maybe I'll toss it to you. I'm so curious about what you think about all that. And particularly, I'm curious if you have confidence in democracy. If you think that democracy is a process through which we can improve the lives of young people with experience in foster care.
Good question. My first point would be how many people from who have experience in care wind up in points of either authority or power who inform democracy, like the practice, very few. That really hasn't changed over the last decade. I think we've seen like a rise of like between 2 and 5 people that are actually notable. But out of the hundreds of kids that have gone through care over the last like decades, if not thousands, we still don't have an accurate picture about what their understanding of democracy is and how they can contribute their thoughts or opinions, ideas, what they would like to see change. And that also stems from the fact that it is not a priority within the ministry to give that education to their kids in care. It's definitely a shortcoming of what we deem valuable. And it's unfortunate because if kids don't know that they have the opportunity to express themselves in a few different ways, nothing's going to really change if there's any inequalities. So we're basically silencing people from sharing what's been happening in their lives, which is very singular to every person obviously going through a system, whether they be Indigenous or non-Indigenous, or from any other minority. And I think it's just, it's quite unfortunate we've fallen so far. The amount of people that I know that was raised in care with, very few have contributed to the conversation ever since, because they don't feel empowered to. So I'll leave it that for now.
Cheyenne, you bring in such a good point about feeling empowered. And one of the things that research really shows us is that if you feel like you belong or you feel like you matter, then you're much more likely to sort of trust your government or believe like you can make an impact, which is then sort of those first steps to being involved. So I'd love to hear kind of more from your perspective around, you know, what do we need to do to help young people who are in care or exiting feel like they matter?
Oh, you guys are pushing all the hard questions on me today.
It's hard. It's so hard. It is.
It's just such a loaded question. And I feel like even this conversation is quite loaded because we're very briefly touching on a lot of shit that's happened over the last couple decades. Mm-hmm. And it's the problem is that it's also coming up to a boiling point as well. So I think one of the more pressing issues too is that democracy and advocacy have kind of come to a head-to-head. So it's interesting. So when I was in care, a lot of people thought how to change the system was them, you know, reaching out through social media. So that was a rise in my time. And that hasn't really trended downward. That's just trended up. It's like where we're at currently. So it's like advocacy has taken the term of where kids and former kids in care should know about their own system and how it actually functions. It's gone two different roads. So there are people that I know that actually work like with the elections, or they're lobbying the government for, you know, real change, but it takes years. It takes years to get anything done. And that is also a problem too, but that's a problem for another time. But people are definitely always calling out for change to something. But I feel like there is a knowledge has not been shared about how to do these things properly. And it's creating a lot of tension in our community. And maybe that's not fair for me to say, but I've just seen it go two ways. I know people that behind the scenes and try to do the paperwork and also try to get people together to get things accomplished. And then I see people who are advocating down on the streets and think that that's all they need to do. And I think it's also created a problem. And a lot of the, or at least a few people that I know that I grew up with, think that that is the right way and that the two are not interconnected. They're separate, and that one is not exclusive to the other, which makes it kind of a problem. In care, I did not see a lot of people sitting down to explain to me how the system functioned. So I had to figure that out a lot myself. But the one thing that I saw was that people I grew up with have now relied on social media to get their messages across and think that that's going to get them where they need to be without communicating to the proper channels within the system.
Your story, Cheyenne, reminds me of sort of what we got to see in the States this summer. So Black Lives Matter, huge protest movement. And then in many of those Southern states, that energy transitioned into, you know, working for the election. And we talked about, you know, these surging rates of people who showed up at the polls to create change. And so I think that you're really onto something there around how we learn to advocate and push for change, like external to, but also then how to, where are the points within the system that are most open to transformation and then really going for them.
It's also communication too, between like people of higher levels and lower levels. Mm-hmm. And it's not as good as it could be.
I'm really curious about this idea of lack of civic education. Cheyenne, I'm wondering if you could share your thoughts on who could deliver this civic education and when we should deliver it and what should be in the curriculum.
Yeah, no, super important question. Well, I think it's the responsibility of everyone, right? But this also has to be a positive sort of conversation. And I feel like for some people in some communities, it's not a source of a positive conversation because some people feel depleted, but other people definitely feel empowered for sure in different groups. I think it should start very young. And I think there's plenty of opportunities to start introducing younger folks into the process. Even when I was in high school, there actually wasn't a lot being taught. And I don't know if that's changed very much. It would be nice to see more schools take an interest to actually encouraging their students to become more active. And so sort of go through the steps with them and also explain to them how these processes work. And then that way the families, you know, of these students can also help them fill in the gaps and try to focus what their ideas and opinions are. And then they can start, once they're a bit older, acting upon them. I think it's huge because MCFD is definitely not a great parent, but, you know, and like, I wouldn't say that the foster parents or even the group homes would be very reliable, but I definitely have more faith in the school system. I would like them to improve. I definitely acknowledge that, you know, there's not enough time to get through the curriculum as it is because there's been lots of additions being made, but I would hope that maybe some of the schools could partner up with maybe an organization that's passionate to start introducing that sooner and younger. I think it would make a huge difference and it wouldn't be left to people that aren't interested in it.
Thanks, Cheyenne. Maybe let's move on to our last question. Let's talk about the media. Jen, I am curious what the data says about how Canadians perceive the media. And I'm curious as well about how the three of us see the media personally. Whether we think the media accurately conveys stories about the communities we're part of. Jen, maybe I'll toss it to you first.
Yeah, I think we're all very concerned around misinformation, the way the media can portray things. I think we forget that the media is many times our role models. You know, the way that people are interviewed on a radio show or not, you know, it's how we might learn to talk to our neighbors. And I wonder, you know, it looks like we're probably headed for a federal election this year. What if every journalist and every debate moderator started with the question that was, so what do you and your opponent agree on? Like, how would that change the dynamics of our media and the way that we listen to them in those ways? And I think that, you know, you in hosting this conversation was also a great start. You contacted me after doing after one of my op-eds was published and wanted to interview me. And I was like, no, we should have a conversation because I can only bring one perspective and it's incomplete. And I'm so appreciative of Cheyenne coming today and really talking about our lack of education and some of these hard questions. And I appreciate, you know, pushing back and saying, hey, these questions are loaded and they're really hard to answer.
Thanks, Jen. And I appreciate you pushing back on that interview quest because you're right. And Cheyenne, maybe I'll toss it to you now. I'm curious if you have confidence that the media will accurately and compassionately portray the communities you're a part of.
No, I am not a believer in media. Journalism, yes. How it's portrayed in the media, no. So I say this for two reasons. One, even when you actually see an issue being reported on the street, say an altercation between the police department and a citizen, when it hits the media, it's like under a paragraph and you don't actually understand what happened and why, versus social media, where it's pretty easy to figure out what happened and why. So why is that? You know, I can find out more on Reddit from the people that were there than I can find from social media. I am in media these days. So it's a bit concerning that the news is so held back than maybe it once was. Definitely the way that people are portrayed is a concern, and how things are kind of being a little bit misled. I know stories ever change and evolve and like people want to record them accurately, but I still feel that half the articles I read, they're not touching on everything that they could be touching, and it's deliberate, versus I can go somewhere else and I can find out for myself 2 times faster with more information that the news is not permitted to use for whatever reason why, or they choose not to. I think that plays a role in politics, and that's just my views on, like, for instance, the police department and how that's reported. Yeah,
I think you make a really good point around the short, abbreviated what happened. And then so much of our media reporting forgets that their job is actually to dig into the backstory to tell us why.
The shortest article I ever found that was definitely highlighting a big thing, and it wasn't updated either because I watched it for like 3 days, was 3 sentences.
Oh my God.
And it was on CBC. It was definitely an issue that was occurring downtown. And I was like, this is quality reporting. I feel like my money's being put to good use.
We're coming to the end of our time together, and I'm trying to think of a way to wrap this conversation up tidily, but I don't know if I can because it's just a messy topic. So maybe what I'll do is I'll toss it to each of you if you have any comments that you would like to leave the conversation with. And maybe I'll toss it to Jen first.
Well, I'm actually really curious, whether this is off the record or not, around Cheyenne, you know, what is for you the most important thing for people to get out of this conversation? I feel like I've taken a bit of airtime, and I, you know that you have, and like you and I didn't really get to chat or introduce each other or get to know each other as people. So I really want to be able to make sure that like I have stepped back and let you really say what brought you to this conversation today and what you'd like, you know, me to take away from it, whether that's on the air or off. I just would love to hear that.
Happy to do both. I'll say a few words here. And if you ever want to talk at another time, we can totally do that. And I'm sorry if you hear any noises above me, that's my neighbor vacuuming. So no, I'm more than happy for you. You're the researcher to share what you want to share. Like even my experience, like it's just, lived experience of like a person, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be that person where one opinion, you know, overthrows all. All these questions about, you know, even democracy and how we're interacting with it as a society currently, and the different dynamics and different communities and groups. It's ever evolving for sure. And we're definitely not at the level we all want it to be at. It's just about, you know, communicating and trying to make it better and encouraging positive communication rather than, you know, silencing people in favor of something they think is important at the time. I see a lot of people paying lip service rather than doing positive communication. They'll engage in a conversation and quickly withdraw once they get either the information they want or a portion of the conversation they think they needed to have to check a box and move on, to say that they paid their contribution to society by engaging in this one conversation. And that is very present in politics, I think. And that's just a feeling. And I don't want to be inauthentic to a conversation. And even when we were opening earlier, like, this whole conversation is super loaded. There's so many levels to it. And I wish we could have the time to actually really get into it and dissect some of it. But the final thing I just wanted to add is that I really do think democracy and advocacy are separate. I think there is overlap between the two. But I think the way that we're informing our young people about how to engage their ideas, their opinions, how to make change is conflicting. And when the results don't come as quickly or as expected, it creates a little bit more distrust and uproar in our communities. And I see that a lot. And it kind of makes me sad because I see people who maybe are on the different spectrum, different levels of engagement, people are starting to get angry with each other for not engaging more or engaging less. And that's just a concern.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's a lot of anger right now, and there's a lot of angst. And how we move past it into productive things, I think, is what will make or break us in the short term. And anger can be a very productive piece because it does unite people and it does create change. But I think your points are really great around what it means to do, you know, lasting change in a very difficult environment. And I love that you brought up how slow structures are in this conversation, because government does work really slowly. And part of our civic education needs to be being comfortable with that slowness sometimes, and what it means to be frustrated at how slow the process is. As it does, it checks and balances as the gears slowly turn, because it is such a glacial pace that you're unaware of until you're in it. You know, when I volunteer, I live in New Westminster. So I didn't understand it until I volunteered for some city council committees. And then you're like, oh my God, it's so slow. Why is it so slow? And then looking for what you can change. So I think you bring up a good point around making that as part of our civic education too. And then how do we promote dialogue that gives us space to unpack this stuff together? Because it's lengthy, it's hard.
And more research and more developments are coming out every day too, right? And even when you do achieve the change that you want, it's no longer satisfying by the time you get there too, is another thing I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
Because the dynamics have changed once you get there, right?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a change. Like, what was it? Someone was saying that's kind of one of the highlights of not, if you can ever say there's a highlight for Trump, is that now you're like, oh, this little change is actually like a real change. I can see it. I don't know where I'm going with that. I was thinking of Biden's presidency. They now have pronouns. When you send an email, you can choose your pronouns to the White House. And like, it's such a teeny tiny change, and it's such a no duh change, but for government, it's ginormous, and we don't stop to celebrate it or look over it. So I think that you make a really good point there about celebrating the win. So I want to know, Cheyenne, from you, what makes you optimistic?
Oh, optimistic. I think my optimism died quite some time ago. I think it's just more I rationalize things and either accept it or I don't, and try not to think about it. But I do have a question for you. What was your experience with civic education? Because I know in different in different groups, it affects people differently, mm-hmm. or how they receive education, how they engage with it, especially the people they're surrounded by. How did it impact you?
Yeah. So my story has a couple different layers. So one, I'm American, and we take a lot of pride in our kind of hero perspective of our history. So we got to know and got to learn from a very young age about, you know, our founding fathers. And the other part to know is that I grew up with an immense amount of privilege. And so I grew up in sort of the equivalent of like West Vancouver in kind of the San Francisco Bay Area. And so we talk about how classes reproduce themselves. So I got that from a young age. But mainly I was very fortunate to like history. And I had a very, very good history teacher. And I got to have him for 3 years in high school. And at first, everyone told me he was a communist. And then by the time I was a senior year, I was like, no, he's just a pessimist. He hates every system, and would just be the person who asked those critical questions and then would think it through. In the States, we learned the different steps of how a bill gets made. It was part of our sort of part of where we found pride. But yeah, I think it's really different depending on how you grow up, where you grow up, what kind of school you're at, and really comes down to like your individual teacher.
No, you totally touched on like what I was getting at.
Thank you so much to both of you. And also, sorry to both of you, because I know that as a journalist, when I ask people to share their stories and their thoughts, it can have, often has, an emotional cause and toll for people. So I thank you so much, and I appreciate you and your time.
Yes, thank you. It was great to talk to you both.
Thank you for the invite.
And that's it for today. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO, your super local morning news show here on Vancouver Core Radio 100.5 FM. I'm Tan Macy, and as always, please tell us what you think of the show. I'm at Macy at corpradio.org. That's M-E-I-X-I at corpradio.org. And also, happy Lunar New Year Eve. Ciao. Take care. And that's our program for CFRO, The Pulse.
Your independent news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
Every weekday, 7 a.m., here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Find our previous podcasts and interviews at thepulse.coopradio.org.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.